The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Joining We the People Radio. We're at KCNR 1460, Shasta, Redding. We'd love to have you join us. The phone number to call is 530-605-4567. If you want to chat with us, and we do love the chat room, it's usually on fire. Or if you want to listen to us streaming live, go to wethepeopleradio.us. So welcome again. You're joining your hosts, Aaron Ryan and Elizabeth Woodward, and Bob Martin, our engineer for this morning. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, ladies.
Hello, Miss Elizabeth.
So nice to see you guys. I don't know about you, but I had a hard time pulling myself out of bed this morning.
Yeah. Everybody else
on the road didn't, though. On my my 21 stoplights on my way to the studio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you got to love that.
Still busy out there, huh?
It just still has 21 stoplights.
Hey, so if this is your first time tuning in to this particular show, let me tell you a little bit about what we do. We are all about limited government, and just to kind of spell the rumors that we believe in no government, not true. We believe in limited government, fiscal responsibility, and adherence to the Constitution. So you'll find that the topics that we bring into the realm of this radio show are all related to one or all of those premises underneath the umbrella of We the People Talk Radio. We are all about We the People. And we do try to keep our issues regional, statewide, nationwide, so that no matter where you're at, if you're tuning in and listening, there's something here for you and something you can share with your friends and family no matter where they live. Because the issues that face us everywhere no matter where we live.
And, you know, just so people know, I was in here on the website, and if you go to wethepeopleradio.us, you're going to click on the Listen Live button. And about a couple hours after the program, later on this afternoon, that button turns into a Listen button, which is actually the archive of the program. So you have the ability to send that web page to somebody else, and they can listen to the program. Any updates on any of the programs we've done before, like you'll see them in that red and white striped part of the flag up above it, any of those programs that update in the future, the web pages will update, and we don't have to email them to you because they're live pages. So if you check back on programs that you liked, if you want to see what happened with legislation or different things like that, those updates will all be on there. So it's a pretty cool program.
And you know, in this world of technology, the thing that spreads news the fastest is our technology. And so we've made this really accessible to you and really easy for you to share. I mean, you know, the couple of clicks of the mouse and you're good to go. You can spread this news far and wide.
Yeah, and I'd get on the chat room if I were you, because we have somebody who logged in as Dances with Sheep.
This is going to be a good one today, I can tell.
I almost burst out laughing while you were talking. I'm like, no one's going to know why I'm laughing. Not that it's imperative that you know why I'm laughing, but Dances with Sheep, that's a funny one. So this morning we are talking to John Menke, M-E-N-K-E. John's resume, we're going to put it on the site, on this page for you, because it is, it's extensive. He's done a ton of writing. He's a professor. I'm bringing this thing up here. I had to obviously shut my laptop off to get here, but I'll give you a few highlights from that. But I know John from Siskiyou County. He lives out in the Scott Valley. They raise Angus beef, bred for tenderness. And I'm thinking, there you go.
Yum.
Yeah, so I keep going there when it's not dinner time, which is a huge mistake. I need to go there during dinner time. But he knows. He's my source for things like all the water issues up there. When they say, oh, the water master is doing something, I had to go get, you know, some water master 101. I didn't really know what the water master does. John's really, really plugged in on all the things that are going on with the fish up there. And for those folks that don't know, since it just happened, I don't know, yesterday, I guess it was, or day before, Friday, John McCammon, the head of Fish and Game up here, is retiring. So initially, that was kind of exciting because Fish and Game is all over those guys up there in Siskiyou County, along with a bunch of other agencies. But it's like, oh, maybe we get a break. No, we don't get a break. We get a guy named...
They're bringing in the big guns.
Chuck Bonham. And Chuck is, you know, the favored son of everything that has to do with, you know, fish and environment and all that stuff. So we figure there's a full court press coming now, just in case that wasn't a full court press before.
And, you know, I don't think we can say it enough that for people listening or people that don't live in the Scott Valley, you know, whether you're in another state or whether you're further south in California, you know, you listen to these issues that these ranchers and farmers are fighting up there. I mean, this land has been in some of their families for, you know, 100 years or more, and no one is a better steward of the land than a person that is living off the land. I mean, clearly, if they're relying on that land for their sustenance, they're going to take good care of it. So that being said, the fight that they're embroiled in up there with the state and federal agencies, if they lose that fight, it starts heading down here. None of us are really safe from that.
No, especially when, you know, I mean, they grow our beef and there are, I mean,
yeah.
we're literally putting, you know, pushing our farming and ranching community off the land. And
do you want to get your meat from China, really?
Totally. And I wasn't sure we still aren't sure what to call this program. I went on a tour of the dams up there, Copco Dam and Iron Gate Dam, and there are four. We're going to put a map up on the site for you so you can see where they are. But the plan is to take those dams out. They are hydroelectric dams. Now, hydroelectric is the super clean source of power. One of those dams, the one big dam, was built in 1918. I don't have the years on the others, but you know what? It's fine. There's nothing wrong with the dam. It's perfectly good, holds back all sorts of sediment, all those kinds of things. There are people up there who live on those reservoirs that are created. So here you have some folks have lived there a long time. Other people, some of which I met on Thursday, some of whom I met on Thursday, they spent their life savings to build their house up there, and now they're going to be on a mud hole.
Yeah.
All for the fish, and you're going to learn from John here that actually that just doesn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Doesn't have anything to do with it.
That's the convenient excuse, I think.
I've got his resume up, and I'm definitely not reading the whole thing, but I'd encourage you to go take a look, because a lot of times you think, well, you know, these people just live there. They probably don't know a lot. And you have all these scientists with the state and federal agencies who are experts. And so, you know, of course, these guys don't want their lifestyle interrupted. So it's just self-interest that keeps them fighting this. Well, I would beg to differ on many, many fronts. John is just one of many people who would be absolutely more qualified than any of the agency people up there. His academic degrees include a PhD in range ecology from Colorado State University, master's in agronomy from the University of California at Davis, range management, Bachelor of Science at the University of California, Davis. He's been a range ecologist. He has been a professor. He has written six pages of small type on the resume, all the different papers he has published. So we've got guys who know what they're talking about, who have done the science, and who still know people who do real science. And we're going to get into that here. I think we'll take an early break. How's that? We'll take an early break, the first segment, and we're going to come back in 2 minutes. We're going to start off with John Menke, and we're going to be talking about the coho salmon there up in the Scott Valley and all the other places John would like to take us on this little tour. We'll be right back with you at We the People Radio. You're listening to KCNR 1460, the home of Free Fire Media.
This is KCNR, the home of Free Fire Media.
I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me.
Don't mess with us. Welcome back to We the People Radio. Give us a call. Please do. Jump in. 530-605-4567. Go to our chat room. It's always alive and well. Or listen to us streaming live. WeThePeopleRadio.us. And we're always interested in what you think out there. It doesn't matter where you live. These issues are pertinent to everybody. They're gonna come after all of us, so hesitate to jump in and get involved.
We're going
to
talk fast this morning. We've got John Menke with us, who is explained to me before, he's an ivory tower scientist, so he's the scientists talk to. And he's going to give us, but he's fun. See, that's kind of, and people are going, oh no, you know, we've got to listen to science all morning. No, fun science. And he's going to explain why a lot of this stuff doesn't make any sense. So I guess we have him on hold, yes? Or not?
He's on right now.
He's on right now, John. Are you in there?
I'm here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So we've seeded the clouds. It's your time to make it rain.
Okay. Well, what I'd like to start off with is this is kind of a historic day. By the end of the day today, that is at midnight tonight. The flow in the Trinity River will be ramped up to 2,650 cubic feet a second. This is for a ceremonial boat dance in the Hoopa Square on the Hoopa Reservation over in western part of the state. And what this ramping up is, began at 8 o'clock this morning. The base flow in the Trinity is about 450 CFS this time of year by law. Or a record of decision a number of years ago, before the dams went in on the Trinity, the flow at this time of year was typically about 125 CFS. So the record of decision a number of years ago boosted that up to 450. But the Indians that live in the Hoopa, I think, have been talked to by the Bureau of Reclamation in wanting to falsely trigger salmon out of the estuary, like they did in 2009, and they're doing it again this year. And the purpose of that is to get those salmon to come up into the Hoopa Valley, because salmon season opens September 2nd. And why not bring the fish up at the beginning of the season? Well, the problem is a lot of them don't take a right turn down at Wichipack on the Klamath River and go up to Trinity. They head straight and go all the way up to toward Iron Gate Dam. And a lot of them, because the early fish in the estuary typically were Shasta River fish, a lot of them try and make it up to Shasta. And irrigation is still going on in Shasta Valley, so the flows in the lower Shasta are really insufficient to allow the fish to come up through the canyon very effectively. It's a lot of big rocks and stuff, and if there's not pretty good flow, fish cannot get up. And in 2009, they did the same thing, and the result was the river keepers called our water master and complained about why don't those irrigators in Shasta Valley turn their water off. But in fact, if nature were allowed to operate the way nature had operated for millions of years with these salmon, the river wouldn't come up until fall, later, much later in the fall. This is still summer. The thing that makes rivers naturally come up is when the leaves fall off the deciduous trees, that is the broadleaf trees that are finished their growing for the year. They drop their leaves, their transpirational demand, that is the water that they lose through their leaves, in taking up CO2, producing leaves and boles in trees or shrubs. When they drop their leaves off, they no longer transpire much. And that causes streams to naturally come up in the fall. So what we've got going on here really is a planned program by what I will talk about more later, a predatory agency. The Bureau of Reclamation is working to remove agriculture from the whole Klamath River Basin. Robert Whitaker came out here in the late 50s and early 60s, an ecologist from Cornell, and recognized the high biodiversity of this region. It is incredible. There are more conifer species up here than in a small area than any place in the world. Biomes of California grasslands, Doug fir forests from the coast at very high rainfall, desert ecosystems from the interior dry deserts of Nevada-type Great Basin environments in the Upper Klamath Basin. They all come together, and the species kind of mix in here. It's a botanist's dream. And this was recognized not long after the Agenda 21 program in 1992 began. And when George Bush Sr. signed off on that agreement to basically get the United Nations involved in managing landscapes around the world, and particularly trying to get control of this big kahuna, the United States of America. So what we've got going on is we got an agency this morning agreeing to a boat dance event. If you don't know what that is, I've never been to it, and I like the Indians very, very much. I've done management plans for the Round Valley Indian Reservation in the early 70s and the Tule River Indian Reservation over near Porterville, California, down by south of Fresno. I worked with them all my life. But they're being used by the government now as a device to take control of land and water and property rights. So this is the real mess we've got our government's got us into. And today is a historic day because here's the second event of the Hoopa boat dance where it's being used too early in the year. These salmon are put under stress to have them come up this early. In the fall, after it cools off and the leaves are all done, the water in all the whole system cools down. So these predatory agencies are willing to go ahead and bring these fish up early just to get the press and the media. It's kind of a product of the internet and rapid communication that allows them to spread this damage. And where I want to go with this is really goes back to the late 1960s. A man by the name of Garrett Hardin published in Science Magazine, the most prestigious journal in the world, of a tragedy of the commons. That's what he titled that and later books that he wrote. He ended up becoming a professor emeritus at UC Santa Barbara. I never met the man, but I met a protege of him, John Bodden, from Montana State, when Bodden came out to California to either do a sabbatical leave or just a visiting professorship in resource economics at UC Davis. And I went over and heard his seminars, and I was intrigued with the information, and it affected me my whole life. And it's coming together right now beautifully because I've bought Bodden's books and Hardin's books. But more importantly, our farm advisor up here, Dan Drake, last year happened to see on the internet that a woman in Bloomington, Indiana, of all things, who had been cooperating with resource economists at Berkeley for a number of years, and I know Richard Norgard at Berkeley, he was a colleague of mine when I was there during 1973 through 78 on the Berkeley campus. I was in the Forestry and Conservation Department at the time. Actually, it was its own college, our school. It was a wonderful system. Anyway, Dr. Eleanor Ostrom in 2009 got the Nobel Prize in Economics for her book, really, and her other works before that called Governing the Commons. And what Eleanor's contribution was to get that Nobel Prize, and it was a shared prize with a Berkeley person who I do not know, wasn't Richard, but another professor there. They have a fine resource economics program at Berkeley. What she got the prize for was showing through case studies all over the world that commons problems are never solved by governments. In fact, they make things worse.
Imagine that.
And what they do, though, is they spend tremendous amounts of money trying to do it. And so, in a nutshell, Eleanor's and her joint receiver of the 2009 Nobel Prize in Economics. We're not talking about a peace prize here. We're talking about a real Nobel Prize. She got it for being able to show that when governments get involved in trying to solve commons problems, and I'll explain what they are here in just a minute, the budget goes infinite and there's no solution. I've been noticing that here. I've been here for 18 years now, and I saw about 20 years of the Klamath Project, which is $1 million a year to solve this issue of these fish. They haven't produced any more fish. With the exception, maybe we're producing more coho, probably due to my own ranching operation here, because I happen to have bought a ranch that has a phenomenal, good, high-elevation sourced water right with some storage, which most places don't have. And my wife and I have been working judiciously now for 18 years with flood irrigation to provide cold water accretion to a small tributary stream of the Scott River, and we produce thousands and thousands and thousands of coho salmon rearing habitat on this little creek every single year. I think most of those 924 coho that came up last year probably came out of the Scott Mill Creek system on our ranch. And Dr. Peter Moyle and Dr. Jeff Mount, who have been here with their class studying our system, they're both at UC Davis. And I knew Peter because he's a little older than I am, but our children are just about the same age. A boy and a girl each, and they're all good friends. We're all good friends with Marilyn and Peter. They had their class up here of seven students for a week, and they had seven students at each of two other creeks in Scott Valley to understand these systems. And we got an A-plus rating for our management and our situation of our riparian ecosystem. In fact, the students named our beautiful cottonwood forest, gallery forest, along our Immigrant Creek, which is a tributary of Mill, which is a tributary of the Shackelford Creek. They called it Menke's Magic Forest. We've actually got 60-inch diameter DBH cottonwood trees on here and wonderful coho habitat in here. So anyway, what I want to talk about, though, is maybe I could ask Aaron, should I go on now with going further into what a commons is, and then I'll go into that more thoroughly after we chat?
I think so, because we've got a couple minutes till our break, and that idea of the commons was something you had to explain to me yesterday, so I'm sure everybody else is going, what is he talking about? So sure, fire away.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, what Hardin discovered was he started thinking about, I think he's a resource economist, or an economist more than I am, although we are economists to a degree because we have to watch our own bank accounts. But anyway, he started to meld two subject areas together, ecology and economics. And he actually did a little case study or description of a meadow ecosystem where different grazers had access to a limited resource, forage, on a meadow. He didn't describe where it was. I've done lots of work on meadows, but he didn't really tell us where it was. It might have been a hypothetical meadow. But anyway, when you have multiple users of a common pool resource, a CPR, a common pool resource, the tendency is for different, just because of the nature of human nature, there's tendencies for people to take more than their fair share. And what this means is that eventually the meadow declines in condition. This was actually the subject of my PhD. If you look at some of my early papers on my resume, I dealt a lot with rest, rotation, the effect of rest from defoliation of plants. Defoliation here is we were simulating grazing by hand clipping plants, about 13 different species of shrubs, grasses, and forbs, to look at the effects of grazing. Well, what Garrett Hardin was talking about is when you have a common pool resource and you have humans involved, you end up with what are called free riders. Those are a classification of people that will come in and out and use the resource, and they will take more than their share, and they won't stick around to deal with the consequences. And therefore, those that are using the resource fairly under any kind of interhuman relationship among the parties, the free riders end up screwing up the system because they take more than the resource can handle. And the tragedy of the commons is that the resource declines, the productivity declines, and you lose the resource. That's what we've got going on in the Pacific Ocean and the Klamath River system. We've got exploitive actions by a number of parties, which we'll get into after the break, as to why that fishery is declining. It's because of exploitive action by free riders and the permissiveness of governments to promote free riding. And the other interesting term, and this is generated out of the economics literature. The other the social scientists are typically more innovative than biological scientists, and they coin interesting terms. The term that I like particularly is what's called the prisoner's dilemma. The people that are parties to a common pool resource, they become prisoners to the resource. And they're prisoners to each other, because if you cheat, you hurt yourself as well as the others. That's like the free rider. The free rider, though, is not even a party to the deal. So what we've got is we've got a promotional program by our predatory agencies. I refer to them as predatory because they are using a tragedy of the commons to have to reduce the opportunity for private property rights and ownership of land. They're trying to move us off. So I better stop there.
Okay. We're going to take a two-minute break. While we're doing that, if you'd like to see where we are talking about geographically, go to wethepeople.us, and Robert has put up a map there that has the rivers, it has the dams, and it has a couple of major cities. It's a really good map, so when he starts talking about these rivers and things, you can actually see where that is, give you some perspective. So we'll be right back with you here on KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
If your tax advisor tells you your legal deductions are red flags, it's time for North State Consultants in Reading. Our team specializes in reducing your tax liability using IRS policies and administrative law. As the most aggressive and qualified tax preparation and audit litigation specialists in the business, we offer tax and trust assistance with audits, late filings, overdue taxes, and more. For more information, visit our website at northstateconsultants.com.
Join the conversation in our chat room, KCNR1460.com.
Don't let them kick your neighbor off his land. This is where we gotta make a stand. The stewards of this land are mom and pop. The government couldn't run a soda shop. I said freedom, freedom. Watch it slipping away. I said freedom, freedom. A little bit more each day.
Now that is our own great Mike Smith, a wonderful patriot from Corning, California. He's on the chat room right now, so if you like that song, there's like 11 more on his CD. I have it. It's fabulous. If you want to buy one, jump on the chat room and find out from Mike how you can get a hold of one of those. So you're listening to We the People Radio, 605-4567. Give us a call. Join in the chat room or streaming live at WeThePeopleRadio.us. We're talking about dam removals and mock science when it comes to the salmon runs and
the old faux science,
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, and its impact supposedly, allegedly, mystically,
just keeps
on the
coming.
Environment.
So we have John Menke with us this morning. He is a rancher and a scientist. And it's got tons of credentials, tons of experience, and very involved with the groups up there. Hey, John, why don't you give people an idea of where Scott Valley is? I know we've got our map of our rivers up there, but
yes, guys. Scott Valley, if you come up Interstate 5 from Reading and pass Weed and pass it through the Shasta Valley to the north end of Shasta Valley and turn off, there'll be a Fort Jones Etna exit there in Wairika. That's where Burger King and Carl's Jr. and McDonald's and all the other restaurants are there. And you take over Highway 3, actually heading down toward Trinity Center in Trinity Lake. You come over Forest Mountain in about 4 miles and drop into Scott Valley. And it's a long alluvial valley, about 28 miles long. It drains out of the Trinity Alps, the Russian Wilderness, and the Marble Mountain Wilderness areas. And it's really a fabulous place, and it's a highly productive alfalfa and grass hay and now wheat production. We'll get into more of that later. And a lot of cattle. So it's an ideal system. It's surrounded by dry mixed conifer forest, the Front Range of which is productive for water. We'll get into that more later, too. We've got complete mismanagement of our forests as well, and so for the water delivery out of these upland watersheds, which is the vast majority of the Scott River watershed, only about 30,000 acres is in the valley bottom. It's about 280,000 acres of upland forest, and a large majority of that is overgrown, highly dense conifer forest, completely mismanaged, highly fire-prone, ready to burn, and isn't producing much water. And so we'll be getting into water commons issues here before today and get into those issues more thoroughly. What I wanted to do, though, is I wanted to link back for a minute just with one case study. It's my own understanding. Eleanor Ostrom didn't dwell on this particular one, but I think it's a good one to illustrate the tragedy of the commons of another system before we get into the fishery. During the 80s and 90s, our State Department was highly influential in African ecosystems. As you're all aware now, the Chinese are in there trying to pick up as much resources as they can for their growing economy. Well, I think the United States was in there politicking as well. And there was a tragedy of the commons in sub-Saharan Africa. This is south of the Sahara. The countries of Mali, Mauritania, Niger, and other countries along that sub-Saharan belt. You're all aware where the Mediterranean Sea is, and then all the countries where all the fighting's going on in Libya and Algeria and Egypt. Well, south of there is the Sahara Desert, and then below that is called sub-Saharan Africa. Well, there were lots of nomadic peoples there that grazed their flocks, mainly of sheep and goats, small ruminants, for thousands of years. The Peace Corps young people went over there with funding from the State Department, that is the U.S. government, to help in problem solving. They went in there and they saw these nomadic peoples and saw what they were doing to make a living, and they felt sorry for them. These people were nomadic, that is, they followed their flocks seasonally wherever the forage was green. That is, they followed thunderstorm rainfall events, and they had a phenomenally interesting language and complex descriptors, much better than the English language, describing to each other where they likely could find forage. Those people, though, were viewed by these Peace Corps people, these do-gooders. And we're loaded with them everywhere in the Enviro groups today. They're do-gooder people. They thought we could make things much, much better for you if we could stop you having to walk so far with your flocks. In fact, the men left the area and took the flocks out on long journeys to feed their flocks, and then they would come back to where their families were with fat lambs. They would have a big feed slot. Remember, these people don't have any storage for their meat. They would dry it, make jerky, all those sorts of things. They would come back with their fat animals and feed their families. The State Department went in there following funding the Peace Corps, young people, completely untrained people. These were people that got a degree in English, or maybe didn't even get a degree at all. Let's join the Peace Corps. We can't get a job. Let's go do that. Let's travel the world. Let's have fun. They went over there and they misread the situation. They said, we ought to settle these people so they don't have to walk so far at such drudgery. What the U.S. government did is they went in there and drilled wells. Over there they're called boreholes, B-O-R-E, boreholes, with dip sacks made out of guts of animals with a rope and a fulcrum to dip down in these wells, and then they could water their flocks. And those poor sheep and those poor nomadic men wouldn't have to walk so far, and they could be right around their women all the time, and the whole family could be much, much happier.
And don't you find that the arrogance is almost overwhelming, that, oh, my God, how did you ever survive this long until we came along to show you how to do it?
Yeah, I had a student, Avi Paravolotsky, from Israel, who did a study with me and Ben Orlov there at Davis, at UC Davis, on goat grazing in Peru. And he'd spent a lot of time with the Bedouin tribes in Algeria. Avi's a brilliant scientist. And we got him his PhD, and he was well worthy of it. He told me the language these nomads had was phenomenal. He said, by comparison, the English language is so depauperate you can hardly even explain grazing conditions. Those nomads had hundreds of adjectives to explain how good the grazing was going to be over that way, 150 or 250 miles, because through the network of communications of nomads moving around, they learned that there had been a tremendously big thunderstorm over there, and there would be thousands of acres of good forage. Well, here the State Department with their emissaries, the Peace Corps, comes in. They drill the boreholes, I got to finish this quick, because we got to get on the salmon here in the Klamath Basin. But this is a tremendously applicable story. They settled the people. They overgrazed all around the boreholes because everybody stayed around. They sat on their butts and they got fat. Think of obesity now. This is what our country's doing to our people right now. It makes me sick. I've got two grandkids, and luckily my son-in-law is active in sports. He plays a professional frisbee. He teaches molecular biology at Oregon State and Lynn Benton Community College. He works hard. He's tall, thin. They're marathon runners, and so is our daughter. They're not fat. Anyway, they settled these people. They made them fat. And here's where my part comes in. They destroyed the rangeland there because all those nomadic sheep just completely abused the area around all these boreholes. Now, here's my interpretation of another thing, and this may be not exactly correct, but I'll bet it's partially correct. They kept all these men home, and Aaron will know the trouble of men. When you got men around with not too much to do, what do? They start screwing all the other women.
Oh!
And this probably led to a tremendous expansion of AIDS in Africa. As our State Department went in there and helped everybody out to make them easy, they mixed the men and the women all the time. In fact, I chaired the International Agriculture Development Graduate Group at Davis, and we had Peace Corps students coming back that didn't have enough training. We had this program to give them a master's program to help them have better training so they wouldn't make these big mistakes in the future. It's ironic that our local district conservationist here in Wairika was one of those students. He was a student there when I was the chair of the program. I didn't know him at the time. But here's a classic example, and actually my colleagues in agronomy said, you shouldn't chair that program. That's a bad program. Those students aren't getting enough training to really do a good job. Well, my colleagues were exactly right. That program should die.
You know,
because
John,
that program gave an artificial representation of skills in their students. They got just a master's. Then they go out and get jobs, and we get them up here, and they come back up here and become our nemesis. The Natural Resources Conservation Service has become our nemesis up here. That's terrible. I worked with them for many, many years at Fort Hunter Liggett, trying to square away the grazing issues at Fort Hunter Liggett, and the NRCS soils database was a phenomenal resource for me to get the carrying capacity estimates for all the different pastures at Fort Hunter Liggett, 145,000-acre military training reservation. It had a beautiful grassland, had a lot of capability for grazing, and it would have too much fire hazard if it didn't have cattle out there. But it was abusively grazed. It was another commons problem.
You know, John,
so I helped square that up with NRCS's help down there, but now NRCS is coming back to bite us. It was called Soil Conservation Service now. And NRCS now has been corrupted as well. And I had a party in that because I was chairing a program where we were training people inadequately. And then they get highfalutin jobs because they've got a nice title on their degree. But they don't have enough training. So we've got commons problems going on all over the place. So it's really sad. I think it even contributed to AIDS of Africa. Our State Department likely settled people and made it too easy so the men weren't out getting away and working. They were hanging around. And in Africa today, the women do all the work. So anyway, and I learned that actually from the students during this international ag. I was chair of the program for about 4 years, and they, the stories they brought back in their weekly seminars, I learned a tremendous amount about Africa. I'd only been to Morocco, and did a sabbatical leave on studying areas in Mali in sub-Saharan Africa where I studied water relations. You'll see that on my papers. The paper was presented in Addis Ababa by my colleague over there, Herman Van Keulen, another Dutchman. It was during my sabbatical with the Dutch in 83-84 when our family went over to Holland and had a fabulous sabbatical leave. I learned a tremendous amount.
Well, we
kind of described Scott Valley. A Scott River goes out of Scott Valley and spills into the Klamath River. And the water, as I said, comes out of nice high mountain elevation areas that are cold water driven, snow melt driven. Of course, you've recently seen in the press the river keepers like they're preparing for another media show with this pulsing of the Trinity starting today. That's going to be about a 5-day pulse. Falsy trigger the salmon, they'll come up, and they won't come in the Scott River. Those early fish like to go up farther upstream. The Shasta River, which is our neighboring valley to our east of Scott Valley, is called Shasta Valley. And it spills into the Klamath as well. It's another major tributary. And then up above that is Bogus Creek, which is much, much smaller. And it's right at Iron Gate Hatchery. It comes into the river right below Iron Gate Hatchery. So we really have three big tributaries in the upper end. But below the Scott River, we have the Salmon River, which has no agriculture on it. And then other smaller tributaries till you get down to the Trinity River, which is a really big one. And then you head on right down the river below Wichipec and go all the way out to the coast. So it's about a 200-mile Klamath River, all told, maybe a little bit more depending on where you started. And, of course, above Iron Gate, you've got other dams. Aaron mentioned those. Yes, the first one went in 1918, Copco 1. And we visited that the last few days ago. And then you go up into the tributaries above the highest dam, which is the Link Dam on Upper Klamath Lake. Since we started with Scott Valley, let me move right over for a minute into Shasta Valley. Shasta Valley, unlike Scott Valley, is not snowmelt driven, except for the little bit of snow that might melt and come off of Mount Shasta. Most of all is lower elevation juniper grassland, sagebrush, steppe type of ecosystem. That means a sagebrush steppe. Steppe refers to the grass understory, and a valley bottom there. The remarkable difference between Scott and Shasta valleys is Shasta, unlike Scott, has a very high phosphorus content in its soils. It's all natural. The apatite mineral is contained in volcanic rocks. And the paramaterials, that is the rocks that those soils were built on, have a high phosphorus content. That has tremendous implications. The reason why is that the phosphorus comes out in the water. And so the Shasta River itself has a very high phosphorus content. For those listening, you might know about phosphorus. It used to be a big component of detergents. It makes for very good detergents and soaps for washing clothing in particular. Until it was discovered the negative effects of phosphorus on water courses, it was put into detergents to make them more effective. Today there is no phosphorus to speak of in any detergents, all been removed. Well, you can't take phosphorus out of soils, and you can't take soils out of ecosystems because they are a part of it. They are a product of erosion and degradation of rock, making the rich productive basis for agriculture and all plant growth and all food for the world. So what we have then is we have a phosphorus-laden stream system in Shasta Valley, where you don't have any of that problem in Scott Valley. Now the problem is algae that grow in water make use of phosphorus. And if you have all this extra phosphorus, the algae growth explodes. What I mean is it grows very, very rapidly and begins to take over the functionality of the water system for those organisms that live in that water system, in this case, the river. So what you have then is with the phosphorus, it tends to promote large amounts of algae. That makes that pea soup watercolor that you see in Shasta Valley today. Actually, you'll see browns as well due to other leaching materials coming out of the soils in that valley that are high in organic material.
Hey, John, on that note, we've got to take a quick two-minute break. And when we come back, you're going to tell us why you guys are using or how you guys are using up all the phosphorus, because you know what? That's another thing. They're going to mess up all the micromanaging agencies. We love them. Hey, be back with us in 2 minutes here. You can jump to wethepeopleradio.us and catch a map of the area that we're looking at and some information about our guest. We'll be back with you at KCNR, the home of Free Fire Media.
Hear us streaming 24/7 on KCNR1460.com.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without pride. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can.
That's what we're here for, folks. We're here to help in any way that we can. You're listening to We the People Talk Radio. Go to wethepeopleradio.us to join the chat room, to listen to us streaming live, and to take full advantage of the incredible wealth and library of information and knowledge that you can share with the click of a mouse. So I was just going to add that when we were talking about the Peace Corps volunteers before we went to break. My niece is currently a Peace Corps volunteer in Ethiopia, and bless her heart, she got a degree in economics, international economics, and really thought that when she joined the Peace Corps, she was going to go somewhere and help folks build their economies. And unfortunately, they don't really give you a choice about what you're going to do. And where did they stick her? They stuck her teaching people how to preserve the forest. They train them to be environmentalists, I do believe. And when you have a conversation with her and find out exactly what quantifiable results have been accomplished by the Peace Corps volunteers there, nothing. Big surprise.
A sad deal.
Yeah, it is. And she's going to come out of the Peace Corps in what?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we've got another program in the United States called AmeriCorps. And I wasn't following any of this, but some of our people in our group up here where we're trying to work on solving our problems here, we've been finding out now the AmeriCorps program is the largest source of money for the environmental groups, particularly Fleetje Pace and the Klamath Forest Alliance and the River Keepers. These people are young people that are getting into politics in resources before they have the resources training. And it's really sad because they don't know what they're talking about, but yet they can do this media job pretty well. And they'll be complaining in about a week and a half when the salmon get up in the Shasta that they can't get up, but they'll fail to tell you that their organizations worked with the agencies to cause the salmon to come up too early, and they actually are stressing the fish by telling them it's time to come because it's not time to come. The hatchery doesn't even start processing fish until the end of September. These guys are bringing them up 30 days early to make a pry. And the AmeriCorps program, we had them on our place. They did a lot of diving here to get pictures of coho salmon. They'd never seen them before. And I thought they were our friends, and I welcomed them. And then they come back and bite you here. In fact, they were at the fair this year. And I won't go into any more. We better get back to the phosphorus deal, because there's one more piece of the pollution issue. And I'm going to tell you, Eleanor Ostrom, for the Nobel Prize winner, considers pollution a common pool resource. So a resource, we normally think of something that's good, a renewable resource like wood, forage, things like that, productivity that uses CO2 from the air and makes wood products and feed for animals that makes our food. She also considers pollution a common pool resource, and that's where I'm headed very quickly here. We're going to talk about several common pool resources that are involved in our issues here in the Klamath River watershed. But let me finish off the phosphorus together. One more critical part. Unfortunately, there are some algae species that are blue-green algae. They actually have a combined nitrogen fixer bacteria that goes with the algae, kind of like pea plants or alfalfa plants that have nodules on their root systems to take nitrogen out of the air. And of course, nitrogen is the number one component of protein in all living organisms, so it's a required nutrient. So these blue-green algae, unfortunately, in a high phosphorus water system, they make the algae growth even more rapid, because actually phosphorus and nitrogen are the two key elements for all living organisms. Naturally, you all know the phosphorus is the major component of bone tissue.
Okay, hold that thought, John. We've got to come back right after the break. It's going to cut us off. We've got 5 minutes of news. We're going to pick up with phosphorus because part of that is really something you need to know. We'll be right back on We the People
here at KCNR, the home of Free Fire Media.
Thank you.
you're just joining us, we're in our second hour. You can join the chat room by going to wethepeopleradio.us. We also have our media page. You can listen to us streaming live, check out our sponsors, an incredible wealth of information, an archival library. With a click of a mouse, you can send out information to just about anybody, anywhere. Thank you for joining us. Today we are talking about all things dam related.
Well, we've got all sorts of issues with fish. And for those of you that have been watching the newspaper, you're going to hear that Chuck Bonham is being appointed to the head of the Department of Fish and Game. So, you know, he's an attorney. He's a huge proponent of dam removal. So we're talking about four hydroelectric dams on the upper part of the Klamath. And in a couple of weeks, we're going to do a program just on the dams. So keep an eye out for that.
You know, and all he needs is a Senate confirmation. But in this now one-party state, we know how that will go.
Yeah. So your job, everyone listening who is frustrated by this, is to find somebody who lives outside your local area. If your local area is a conservative is run by conservatives already, you need to get outside that area. You need to find some of the people who are voting for these guys and putting us in this one-party system in California, and lean on them, educate them, send them programs like this, and let them know what's happening to regular people.
And folks, don't forget, you know, ultimately it's all related to natural resources, water being one of them. And if you think that irrigation isn't your problem, ask yourself if you have a well or a sewer system. You know,
yeah. How'd you like to be? I don't care if you live in an apartment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they'll be telling us pretty soon. You know, how many showers a week we can take, when we can take them.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, the phosphorus up there that's naturally occurring. Phosphorus is a good thing, right? Don't people put that on their gardens?
Yes, they do. Yep. Yeah, it's a fine fertilizer. It's normally put on as ammonium phosphate sulfate. It's a most common one you would buy for fertilizing your lawn. Trouble is up here, there's just too much of it, and as the water rainfall comes in, it leaches through the soil. The phosphorus comes out naturally in the water. And this darn blue-green algae I was talking about when we broke was, it fixes nitrogen for the air. People probably remember back from their classes that 70% of our air that we breathe is nitrogen. So it's very valuable that it is, because that the protein requirements of plants and animals make it needing to be readily available. The unfortunate thing in the water system, it has too much phosphorus in it. When you get a blue-green algae in it, it grows too abundantly. And here's where the clincher is, where I can link to our first time to a regulatory agency. In our area, it's called the North Coast Water Quality Control Board, but there are boards that cover the whole state of California. I think there are about six of them total. I'm not sure on that, but there's a Central Valley Water Quality Control Board that covers the area around Redding and that part. But anyway, our North Coast Board, when they analyzed the Shasta River, they had it dissolved oxygen and nutrient and temperature impaired based on the Clean Water Act rules. And that dissolved oxygen is a result of the phosphorus and the blue-green algae. Now, let me explain quickly what it is. When the algae cells are out in full sunlight, they're producing oxygen in the water. As they take up carbon dioxide out of the water, just for those of you that don't remember what photosynthesis is, that's when plants take up CO2 and produce oxygen. And they produce carbohydrate, which is sugars, and which is what you eat from plants, or starches. Anyway, or structural materials, all three. So when the algae, though, does this, it makes use of the nitrogen in the air. It allows those cells to grow abundantly, divide, and make more and more of themselves to the point that they overdo it. And during the day, the algae content, if it's very, very high, the oxygen content of the water actually gets too high sometimes. So the fish actually, their metabolism speeds up too much, almost like if you were on an oxygen tank, like people that smoke, that have emphysema, that have to have those little masks over their face when they're walking around and carrying a tank of oxygen. Well, if they put too much oxygen in, their bodies will react, and they can die of too much oxygen. So you have to keep the concentration as you're breathing about right. Well, when you have blue-green algae in your water, you can actually have times of the day when there's too much oxygen, but usually the problem is low dissolved oxygen for fish. and other organisms in the stream. And when does that occur? Well, it occurs at nighttime, particularly at the end of night, in the morning, before the sun comes up, because those algae cells that are in the water are breathing all night long, just like you do, and they're taking up oxygen out of the water for their respiration. That is their growth and their maintenance during nighttime. So the algae cells deplete the oxygen during the dark time of day, and by morning, DO, as they call it, dissolved oxygen, can get so low that fish will die. I want to get back a little bit. You like to have, I think, some reference to current news. This Charles Bonham fellow, who came from Caltrout previously as a member of an environmental group, Caltrout's very active in Shasta Valley. And the unfortunate thing is they have been promoting the importance of the coho salmon in that valley, because coho salmon have an extremely hard time living in that valley because of this low DO. Well, the North Coast Water Quality Control Board, in their analysis, they talk about the low DO, but they don't, dissolved oxygen, that is, limitations to fish, but they don't tell you why. Is it high in phosphorus, or why is the DO problem such a big problem there? And here's where I get really bothered again. I wanted to have the experts help the local people in Shasta Valley understand the nature of their problem. And I wanted to get help from the Natural Resource Conservation Service. James Comar is a local soil scientist that's stationed in Red Bluff and assigned to all this part of Northern California. He's an excellent soil scientist. I wanted him to come up here and do some educational programs for the RCD in Shasta Valley.
And that's a resource conservation district for those folks who don't know.
Natural Resource Conservation Service. Their state office is in Davis. Ed Burton's the chair of the whole program, or the leader of the whole Natural Resource Conservation for California. I talked to Ed, and I talked to James Comar in Red Bluff. And I talked to Jim Patterson here in Yreka. I wanted to get their help for them to maybe put up on a GIS map where all this phosphorus problem is particularly high in the soils. And James Comar told me over the phone, I have this in my dams removal scoping comments, which were also covered up to the press by not putting them on the internet by the people trying to take the dams out. I have a 22-page document, which I'll have to help you, Aaron, to get on your website so people can actually read the truth. But the soil conservation, James Comar told me, he says, John, the dams are coming out. You might as well forget your effort. It's a done deal, and I can't help you. Can you imagine a U.S. Department of Agriculture agency telling John Menke, an expert in soil science and ecology of an ecosystem where we have a big problem, a phosphorus naturally occurring in a valley? And that agency telling John Menke, who worked with them, I knew the guys that started the Soil Conservation Service, came out of Texas. I met with those people one time on one of our big national tours with our range coordinating committee for the 11 western states. And I they helped me solve the problems of overgrazing at Fort Hunter Liggett by determining carrying capacity of all the pastures. I already mentioned that. Now I ask for their soil scientist to come up here and help me. He says, I can't help you. And then I talked to Ed Burton down in Davis. He says, John, it's too political a hot potato. Unless you can get a whole lot of political backing and a bunch of science behind you, I can't help you. Now let's go to Bonham. Interesting enough, Chuck Bonham was, I had a Chuck Bonham on my PhD dissertation at Colorado State, but it's obviously a different person. Here's Bonham now. They appointed him because he's got Caltrout connection, because they're a big push up here in Shasta Valley. So that they got a point man now hired in Fish and Game to win the battle in Shasta Valley.
Mm-hmm.
What a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
You can't win the battle for coho in Shasta Valley because the natural phosphorus is the limiting factor for coho. My colleague Jeff Mount and Peter Moyle, I mentioned them before, they're doing studies up on the Big Springs area where you do have some cold water. But you got 42 miles of high phosphorus water and high blue-green algae and low DO for those to get out. It's a disconnected habitat. Yeah, you got some cold water out there, but how are you going to get them from the cold water down to the ocean? The Klamath River, I should tell you, the upper basin, the whole upper Klamath Basin has exactly the same problem. Now we're going to get to some efficiency of my discussion. We've already used up a whole hour. I wanted to get this whole story in before we're done.
Okay, but hold on. We've got to take another break. We're a quarter hour breakers here. We'll be back in 2 minutes so we don't jam you up. We're going to get back on the co-host Sam and the dams and all the stuff like that here at KCNR, the home of Free Fire Media.
If your tax advisor tells you your legal deductions are red flags, it's time for North State Consultants in Reading. Our team specializes in reducing your tax liability using IRS policies and administrative law. As the most aggressive and qualified tax preparation and audit litigation specialists in the business, we offer tax and trust assistance with audits, late filings, overdue taxes, and more. For more information, visit our website at northstateconsultants.com. Joining us in the last 45 minutes of We the People Radio. I think you know the number, but let me give you the website so that you can get all the info on today's speaker, past shows, everything you need to know about all things We the People. WeThePeopleRadio.us. You know, if you look at the really big picture on any of these environmental issues, there is a movement to take our public lands and private land and turn it back to what it was before people inhabited. They want to rewild.
Yeah, and if you look at the map of their stupid wildlands project, you see that Siskiyou County is mostly red, and the other one that's mostly all red is Modoc County. It's not good. Hey, I wanted to put a note in here because you're going to see on the webpage for today's program, you're going to see about Scott Valley POW. And POW is Protect Our Water, and that is the group that has formed out there in the Scott, and with specific emphasis on this issue. Their website where you can track everything is Pie and Politics, P-I-E, the letter N, POLITICS.com. And Pie and Politics is a great place to get your up-to-date information on what's happening up in that valley. Bottom line is, we've got to be really, really vigilant. These guys need our help.
Outgunned,
outmanned.
And there's so many people that just can't relate to this because they live in cities, they live in suburbs, they live in subdivisions. But look at it this way. The thing that was so great about this country is innovation and invention and how we have been able to take the quality of life and bring it to the forefront. Everyone lives a pretty good life in this country. Imagine going back 100 years,
mm-hmm.
which is basically the attempt.
Yeah, and after you have your land taken from you.
And the bottom line is, this
is where these folks live and work.
And if you like the way your life is and how easy it is for you, go back 100 years and ask yourself if that's really how you want to end up.
That's where they would like us. So, John.
Yes. Well, where we were, I was making a couple of comments about limiting factors, and the key limiting factor in the Shasta Valley is dissolved oxygen, and it's all naturally a problem. It always has been a problem, and it always will be a problem. And the studies by Moyle and Mount in the showing the high productivity and the good conditions in Big Springs at the head of Shasta Valley are true. But the problem is you've got a link for those anadromous fish that have to go to the ocean. It's virtually an impossibility for them to get out without having DO trouble, dissolved oxygen trouble. Again, remember, late in the night or very early in the morning, they will be highly stressed. And the other item is, though, that I want to speak about now is since the coho got listed in 2005, by the state of California, There was concern for how these little fish that spawn down there in the canyon part, the lower part of the Shasta River, how are they going to get up the big springs to summer rear? Remember, or probably many of you will be for the first time, coho salmon are the only species of salmon that have to stay over a summer before they go out. The Chinook that come up first, like the one that they're triggering today out of the estuary, those little guys that result from those spawning fish will go out the following spring. They don't stay over in the summer. They come up late fall unless they get triggered, and then they go out the following spring. The little coho, on the other hand, are a smaller salmon and have a different habit and different strategy, and they stay over another summer. So big springs is critical habitat for over-summering. But the trouble is the link from that habitat is so far in a pure anomaly, since it's at the base of the glaciers of Mount Shasta, that's the reason the water's cold there. There are lava tubes that deliver that cold water out of those of those melting glaciers, which happen all the time. That maintains that habitat, but there's no connectivity of that habitat to the ocean that is healthy. Now, let me tell you about an unintended consequence of an action that Fish and Game has taken. We haven't talked about that agency at all, and they're our biggest thorn in our side up here right now, and have been for quite a while. And we'll talk more about them thoroughly here in the next few minutes. But because the bulk of the spawning of Chinook and coho salmon occur down in the canyon reach, not too far from the mouth of the river, down by the Klamath River, those little coho, rather than going out, they've got to find some cool water. So in the spring after they emerge and the water starts to naturally warm in the Shasta River, they head upstream. And some of them get up all the way to Big Springs, travel 40 miles to get up there. Well, the Fish and Game saw a lot of barriers to those fish along the way. And yes, Department of Water Resources, for their weir monitoring and flashboard diversion dams, have been in there for over 100 years in that valley. And Fish and Game, one by one, has taken out those flashboard dams and replaced those with pumps so the water right holders can still get their water. It sounded like a good deal for everybody, except now they're getting bit by the high electrical rates, and some of us feel those pumps were purposely put in there so that then when the high electrical rates happen, the ranchers and farmers that use their water can't afford to get their water, and they already agreed to give up their diversion, so then they get stuck. We have friends that is happening too down in the Anderson-Cottonwood Irrigation District as we speak, off of the main Sacramento River, trading diversions for pumps and then getting stuck with high electrical rates. Then you can't afford your water anymore, so you're all done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the in order to aid the movement of coho salmon, a listed species now, they took out these flashboard dams so they could go right up the big springs. Well, this is one aspect of the North Coast Water Quality Control Board analysis which I find extremely important. They showed that when these algae cells die naturally, and algae don't live very long, only sometimes less than 2 weeks, because as they divide, those cells that don't divide and become decadent, they die and fall to the bottom of the river. Well, that is the source of this high phosphorus sediment that is such a concern on the main stem Klamath, and that's where we're going next. Is behind the big dams. These are just little flashboard dams. Some of them have been in there for more than 100 years. When Fish and Game took those out and put what they call boulder weirs, that is just rock piles that are fairly big rock, rough rocks, so they create little nooks and crannies for the little coho to move upstream through those boulder weirs, they released all that phosphorus sediment from behind those flashboard dams. And that sediment went down, all the way down the Shasta, 40 miles, went downstream in the Klamath and deposited in a little bit of a lower gradient reach, that is a little less steep reach where the water was slower, settled out, and the polychaete worm, which is a vector for disease for all the salmonids, including steelhead, have created an infectious zone clearly documented by Jerry Bartholomew at Oregon State, a fish pathologist, and Scott Foote with Fish and Wildlife Service over in Arcata. They've done superb research, and there are as many as 200 of these very, very small, less than quarter-inch long polychaete worms that are inhabiting the plants and the bases of the plants in the sediment right downstream from the Shasta River. So Fish and Game used stream bed alteration to help the coho get up, but in the process, the unintended consequence was they released the sediment that got in the Klamath River. And as an example, in 2006 and 2008, all the coho, all the Chinook, and all the steelhead, we're talking 5 million Chinook, 900,000 steelhead, and 75,000 coho, which is the guidelines for mitigation and what the hatchery does every year. All those fish, little fingerlings, when they were released in the spring and fall, were infected by a bacteria which is delivered by the polychaete worm to the fish. That gets in their gills, and those fish are leaving the system infected. Fish and Wildlife Service out of Arcata runs screw traps above and below the Scott, above and below the mouth of the Shasta River, and they actually do an inventory of the disease rates of those fish every year, and they've clearly documented the effect below the Shasta River. It's my hypothesis that the release of that material behind the flashboard dams, based on the information from the North Coast Water Quality Control Board process study, where they identified the dropping out of dead algae cells that are high in phosphorus, were sometimes went in a plume on the bottom of the reservoir behind these flashboard dams, as much as a mile above these flashboard dams, because they've been in there for 100 years, and they developed a deposit of sediment high in that phosphorus material and high in other sediments that then were washed out when those flashboard dams were taken out and the boulder weirs were put in to help the coho. So an unintended consequence of the coho's helping the coho has wrecked the whole fishery. Now, even what is being produced at Iron Gate, it's only really a problem in particularly warm years like we had in warm springs when the little fish are being released, when the polychaete worms are more abundant with warm conditions. So what I want to really say here in summary is I would suggest to Chuck Bonham that he make sure he does a complete limiting factor analysis on the Shasta River before he continues to work with his colleagues in Cal Trout, which are big pushers of dam removal, big pushers of getting agriculture out of Shasta Valley, because it is not a fixable system. And all the story about the shade limitations for keeping the water temperature cooler, trying to grow more willow, they can't produce enough willow along the Shasta River to ever make a significant improvement in water temperature. They're so out of whack on water temperature because the groundwater over there in Shasta Valley is exceptionally warm. This really bothers me because while I liked one part of the North Coast Water Quality Control Board, the discussion of phosphorus sinking by dead algae cells as a bioremediation process, they didn't call it that, but we'll get to that here in a minute. Those deposits of algae are a real problem, but the North Coast Board failed to cite David Bogner's extensive review of water quality conditions in Shasta Valley. He published it with DWR, and he's still there in Red Bluff, excellent scientist, excellent report. He reviewed all the conditions, and remarkably, the well log data in Shasta Valley shows extremely warm water temperatures that are natural. And a member of our Siskiyou County Water Users Group, another group I work with, Frank Calarico, who's a geothermal expert, he tells me, oh, why didn't you ask me? I know that. The mantle of the earth near Mount Shasta is so close that the ground is naturally warm over there. And, of course, that's the reason that the Shasta Valley water Shasta River water is warm. It's not due to lack of shade. Those heavy clay soils are not willow habitat naturally. You can maybe get certain willows that come out of desert regions to grow there, but they were not part of nature. That river has always largely been an open river system. Yeah, you'll have cottonwoods here and there, but the percentage of shade cover you get is so small, you'll never make that river cool. So the two biggies, in fact, all three, the temperature impairment, the dissolved oxygen, and the nutrient impairment, they're all natural. Cal trout has been unwilling to allow a limiting factor analysis. I sure hope Chuck Bonham allows a limiting factor analysis to be done. I'd be happy to help with it because we don't have any taxpayer money anymore to spend on spurious projects that are not going to have results. Let me say one last thing related to Shasta Valley, which is particularly bothersome for me. I used to work a lot with the Nature Conservancy because they funded a lot of my grassland study students, and I worked with them for years. Even George Stroud, the main guy there in Mount Shasta, he now is a broker of land. He buys ranches from willing sellers and gets them transferred by easement or other ways to the federal and state government. That's against the Constitution. The Constitution says the federal government's only allowed to own 10 square miles in Washington, D.C., no more. Now, a lot of us agree with Teddy Roosevelt did on getting the forest set aside and the parks set aside, but you got to stop. You can't take all the private land, too. And unfortunately, the Nature Conservancy in at the Busk Ranch there near Big Springs, they tried to get the hole in the ground ranch, and they bought 98,000 acres above Upper Klamath Lake. And then they turn over that, they don't pay the willing sellers what the land is really worth, and 2 to 3 years later the federal government or some conservation outfit will reimburse the Nature Conservancy for 2 to 3 times what they paid for it. It's a great real estate business, but they used to be involved in grassland restoration, habitat restoration, and they've now been switched over to a broker of private land to get it into public or a government ownership.
Hey, John.
And that's not the way America was designed to be. We need to have a lot of open space, private land, where the capitalistic incentive causes people to work hard, produce products, food and fiber for society. And what we're doing is we're shutting off our natural resources. And unfortunately, this particular environmental group, which I used to think they were the top-of-the-line organization for helping preserve nature, when you go down and start doing things and you don't do your science, you're really lying to your clients, that is your donors, that you can do something about it. You cannot fix Shasta Valley. Likewise, you cannot fix the Upper Basin. I better stop there.
All right. We will be back in 2 minutes to talk about the river that's upside down. It's hot at the beginning and cold at the end. We'll be back with John Menke here on KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
All the games people play. Every night and every day now, never meaning what they say now, never saying what they mean. While they while away the hours in their ivory towers, till they're covered up with flowers in the back of a black limousine.
Every breath you take.
We're watching. We are self-appointed, middle-of-the-road, mainstream America.
Got to become scientists now.
We're watching.
I've learned more from John Menke in the last year than I learned from anybody when I was in college, but of course I was an English major, so...
And you know what?
So I wasn't allowed to talk about phosphorus or oxygen.
And for all those people out there with college degrees, do you kind of look back now and say, maybe that wasn't such a...
Actually, I should tell you, Aaron, my sister-in-law down there in Chico, she got a degree in French literature, and she actually, my brother works for the Glen Calusa Irrigation District there in Willows, provides water for 1,200 growers on basically 188,000 acres of rice-type ground, and she tells me it helps her a lot in dealing with her thinking on what the government's trying to do because of what she knows about Napoleon.
Oh, good point.
Yeah, actually, that would be excellent training, wouldn't it? Hey, I've got,
oh, yeah.
Okay, so let's see. In my
in my, you know, we're going to call it kindergarten science. Bottom line is when all this stuff is held behind the dams up there, because I saw it. We were there Thursday. Went to all these dams. And behind the dams, the water is just green, green, green with tons of algae and mossy stuff. And, I mean, it look, you can tell. If you put your foot in there, it would come out and you'd be a sea monster. As it goes through the dams and it goes through all of that, the closer it gets to the ocean, the less of that is part of the water. And actually, the improvement, a lot of the improvement comes from the type of irrigating you guys do, because obviously the crops suck the phosphorus out of the water. I'm sure there's far more scientific terminology, but then as it goes back into the streams and into the river, it's less phosphorus laden, better for fish. So if they take you guys off the land, they take the dams out, they just let this all go back. People should know.
Well, let's get into that because we've only got a little bit more time here. We got to close the story now.
Yeah, we got to help people get
really
that.
Going on. Yeah. The algae you see, and I was at COPCO a couple days ago. We actually got a tour from Pacific Corps, so some of our group could film, and we're doing a documentary, which you're going to hear more about in the future, to put the whole package together from a human perspective, not so much a science perspective, but some science. I recently got a copy of a letter that Peter Moyle and Jeff Mount sent to Fish and Game and Fish and Wildlife Service. I hadn't seen it. It's a 2007 letter that they wrote. And they were worried about if the dams go out, the rate at which the algae material from Upper Klamath Lake gets down to the river, the transit time might be too short. They were for dam removal generally, but they felt that there had to be a lot more scientific study before they risk taking the dams out. And here, let me tell you why it is. In fact, Jennifer and I and our people on this tour, we toured for 14 hours, about 3 hours a day, with the cameraman putting the whole story together for a production documentary, which will be coming out on television before too long. Jennifer and I could even notice, if you drive up along COPCO Reservoir, the big reservoir, actually even Iron Gate, you can see that the color of the greenness is higher upstream, even in the reservoir. And as it passes down through the reservoir, it gets less and less green. It's still green, but less green. We actually have the dams and the reservoirs and the blue-green algae are actually bioremediating. What that bioremediate, you spell it just like it sounds, is scrubbing the phosphorus out of the water, and as those dead algae cells fall to the bottom, the remaining water is cleaner. So the water coming out of these behind these reservoirs is cleaner than that coming in.
Mm-hmm.
The studies that were done, funded by the tribe groups that are members of the KBRA program, that's Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, which is this humongous plan to, quote, restore the Klamath River. Now, we're in the main stem now. We're out of the shafts, and we're heading upstream. We're more than 200 miles now above the ocean. And make sure you listen to something Aaron has got on the website, my interview with Frank Galusha, last week from myoutdoorbuddy.com website, which is part of your ads, so I'm sure it's okay for me to say this.
Oh, absolutely.
He talked to me about coho salmon. Coho salmon really never spawned any more than about within 25 miles of the ocean. They were a coastal spawner in small streams right next to the ocean where you have a summer fog belt of fog. Every summer, people that have only lived in here interiorly all their life and never looked over the hill to see the fog, they don't know about that. But all on the coast of California, down to San Francisco, maybe sometimes south, but not rarely south of there, you get a fog intrusion when it's hot in the valley, like Sacramento Valley. It pulls, it creates low pressure by the heat rising in the valley, and that sucks the fog off of the ocean, and it hugs the mountain front there, right along the coast. And that's where the coho were a native spawner in there. They never were important this far up river, because this river is just too hot, and now that you've heard what I've had to say, the dissolved oxygen troubles and the high phosphorus conditions in both the Shasta and the main stem Klamath in the upper basin is not conducive to coho. So really, the coho, this special unit of coho that we got listed in here by the state of California and the federal government is very fraudulently listed. This is not their habitat, but they are using that as a device to win the battle. And this is a real clincher. Let's get back up to the upper basin in the bioremediation. The best indicator of all, which is unrefutable, is there's 21 million cubic yards of dead algae cells that are decomposing and on the bottom of the reservoirs up to 10 feet thick behind Copco, because it's been in there since 1918. There's still plenty of room for a lot of storage, not a problem, but that 21 million cubic yards of dropping out of dead algae cells is exactly what Peter Moyle and Jeff Mount are worried about if you don't have that bioremediation possible and you get rapid transit of high algae from Upper Klamath Lake right down the river. And that bothers me tremendously, and I can't believe that the North Coast Water Quality Control Board, in carrying out the law of the Clean Water Act, could ever agree to flushing 21 million cubic yards out at one time. They probably put about 5 million cubic yards out when they dumped the flashboard dams out of the Shasta River, or not that much, probably 1 million, or probably 500,000 cubic yards maybe, or maybe only much smaller than that. We're talking 21 million cubic yards. Look at the problems that occur in the infectious zone due to the Shasta River flashboard dam removal by Fish and Game. Look what would happen if you dumped it all. And they're now, because they're short of budget, they're talking about dynamiting the dams and not even taking them out. They just want to get them out to get the electricity away from agriculture. And also make the electricity rates up here so high so that the poor people that live up here, we have a very high unemployment and very low salaries. You put a burden of high electric rates on people that don't have big salaries, they're going to leave. So they're going to evacuate the poorer people first, people that can't afford the solar panels. It's really criminal what's going on. Anyway, let's go right on up now.
Okay, John, we got to take our very last break. Then we'll come back with almost a full 12 minutes to wrap her up. We'll be right back with you here on KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds. Are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Hear us streaming 24/7 on KCNR1460.com.
Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies.
Nice choice.
Tell me lies. Oh, no, you can't disguise.
You can't disguise. Yep. That's the Chuck Bonham theme song.
Yeah, no kidding. Our great pal, Bob Martin, our sound engineer. He knows the music. He's from our time. Great selection, Bob. Kind of wraps it up.
Thank you, Liz.
Welcome back to the last little segment of We the People Radio for this week.
All right, so we're talking to John Menke, who's going to sum up for us in this one bite of things going on up there in the Scott Valley.
I better get with it. I'm watching the clock now.
Yeah, I know. Now the clock is killing us. Go, John.
Yeah, the real problem is, interestingly enough, the agencies got themselves into a bind when they listed the sucker fish in Upper Klamath Lake. There are a couple of sucker fishes that are native to the upper basin, particularly Upper Klamath Lake and the Lost River. And that's above the Link Dam right there at Klamath Falls, which we're getting way up to the top of the watershed now. So we have... When Aaron gets the map on the website, you take a look at the size of Upper Klamath Lake compared to the reservoirs behind Copco and Iron Gate. It's massive. And when they got the bogus biological opinion from Fish and Wildlife Service up there to make it so they had to keep Upper Klamath Lake full, you have to realize that was so the farmers couldn't have much water. That was the real motivation. But in there, getting that opinion and protecting, quote, protecting the suckerfish when it lived there for 10 million years with no link dam there. It had a barrier dam there that was natural, but they raised it. It doesn't need to be high like that. But what they do, what the KBRA agreement that all these stakeholders are party to, aren't going to take the link dam out, and they can't make the lake shower, and that's the primary source of blue-green algae. That's where it all comes from, and from even above there, the high phosphorus water, and the same thing we talk about for the Shasta River. I should tell you, the Shasta River is a fabulous system because it is a model for the upper basin. It's the same processes. We don't have to go over those again. Phosphorus, blue-green algae, acetylene processes that bioremediate the system. Yes, Aaron was right that the water from Upper Klamath Lake should be used maximally by agriculture to produce food with no phosphorus fertilizer allowed. And that hasn't been in the cards in the previous management of the Upper Klamath Basin. You are not allowed to put ammonium phosphate sulfate on. You can only put urea on and other fertilizers that contain no phosphorus, just like the ban on phosphorus in detergents. It wouldn't be a problem for agriculture. They can get around that. The high phosphorus soils in the whole river basin and all the Klamath projects since 1905 have created a mecca for productivity. Well, it is also a mecca for using the phosphorus up. So rather than decreasing the area of agriculture, you should maximize it for the benefit of the Klamath River. So all the as much as you can take, the biological opinion for Upper Klamath Lake needs to be re-looked at and revised to the normal level that the lake was at for the 10 million years before any humans came to North America. Remember the Native Americans, we call them Native, they only came here 10 to 14,000 years ago, longer than us. But there were many more years that those fish were there before any humans had any impact. So the point is the Upper Klamath Lake is not part of KBRA. It's going to continue to send that bad water down. And here again, the Nature Conservancy got snookered in buying all those properties above Upper Klamath Lake. They're creating wetlands to bioremediate, they say, they don't use that term, the phosphorus. But in fact, they're not exporting any phosphorus out of the basin at all. Phosphorus does not volatilize and go up in the air like nitrogen. So they are not doing anything to improve the problem. In fact, they're creating worse problems because they're attracting more ducks and geese. And those two species maximize the availability of phosphorus because they're dung that they defecate in, their urea and their phosphorus comes out in a slurry, and they go all around the landscape of Upper Klamath Lake and all around Klamath Falls and all the irrigated pastures, graze on those grasslands, then come over and land on these wetlands and defecate in the rest wetlands. And can you imagine one duck landing on a reservoir day after day can make the water unpotable? So what they're proposing to do as an expansion of wetlands is the antithesis of what the Klamath River needs. They're looking for jobs for their own agencies, and from what friends of mine tell me up there, the agencies are falling all over themselves, hoping to get this $1.4 billion for a totally bogus KBRA program to try and finish off agriculture, and they're doing it well right now. They bought 98,000, that is, TNC has bought 98,000 from willing sellers of scared ranchers, and they're putting in wetlands, and they're making the problem worse, just like the removal of the flashboard dams in the Shasta River. It's criminal. Now, we've only got a couple more minutes. What I really wanted to say and link back to our common situation, we've got tremendous overfishing going on in the ocean and in the Klamath River itself. A number of years ago, probably more than a decade ago, all the policing and monitoring of the Yurok tribe and the Kurok tribe was turned over to those peoples themselves. The fish are too valuable to have those people hold back. You will have free riders within those organizations that are taking too many fish. And while the fish are really a common pool resource for even agriculture, because the lack of fish for us at the headwaters of these, like Upper Klamath, in Shasta and Scott Valley, the lack of fish is what's biting us, and the fraudulent listing is biting us. So what they're doing is they're overfishing in the ocean, they're overfishing in the river, and they're even overfishing all off the coast of California so they can try and further wreck agriculture in the San Joaquin Valley. My cousin who fishes down in the Sacramento system, they're hardly catching the fish. He has not caught a fish yet this year. They've been fishing since July. NIMS, the National Marine Fisheries Service, which handles all the setting of limits and things with some other commissions and things, they've completely corrupted the data. I've even learned about thousands and thousands of fish heads that were in a freezer in Auk Bay up near Juneau, Alaska, were purposely had the electricity turned off so the coated wire tags could not be retrieved from the Chinook salmon, and that's what they use primarily to set the catch limits. We've got a corrupted federal government, and incidentally, I should refer back to one last thing. That predatory agency concept actually is not mine. It's in John Bodden and Douglas Noonan's 1998 book called Managing the Commons, Second Edition, with, of all things, a foreword by William D. Ruckelshaus, who was the first leader of EPA. Interestingly enough, yesterday, Capital Press has it. I'm looking at it right now. Just came. EPA pioneer speaks out on ESA. He was a Nixon appointment and really tried to do a good job. But we've got a total system of resource management completely out of whack. I'll stop there.
There is so much more, guys. I mean, honestly, I spent Thursday, Bill and I went up there Thursday, and we went from 6 in the morning until 7 at night. We went through all the dams. Yep. We went on all the tours, talked to different people at different places along the way. And
Aaron, I just thought of one last thing. We got just a second longer here. What the real issue is in the ocean is what's called bycatch. While they're running these trawler canneries up in Alaska, and incidentally, a lot of our coho go all the way up to Alaska, when they're fishing for pink salmon and chum salmon and humpies up there, the bycatch on coho and Chinook can be extremely high. And along our coast of California, where we have a endangered coho on the coast, not the one we have, they have another unit right on the coast, the bycatch by people, sport fishermen out there fishing for Chinook, when they hook a coho fight so hard, and when people handle them, my cousin who goes out in the ocean quite frequently, he is appalled seeing the dead coho lying on the water that people have released when they're trying to catch a Chinook. Fish and Game needs to set bag limits on the total catch allowed per person per year, not per day, because we've got so many retired people like my cousin. Well, some years he'll catch 40 to 50 salmon, giving them away to his friends and everything. He loves to catch salmon.
Holy cow.
He's part of the commons problem himself.
All right, John.
Bycatch and other things.
You got to come back on with us, buddy, because everybody's asking, when are you coming to visit? So we're going to do more with John Mankey on a different day. We're out of time here. You've been listening to Be the People Radio.
Yes, don't forget Sovereign Minds.
Tonight at 6.
KCNR, 6 o'clock.
All right, guys, plug in wethepeopleradio.us. Send the sound file to your friends. This is KCNR, 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
Stay tuned for Dr. Doug Craig after the news here at KCNR Shasta Redding.